Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's one thing we always hear about running, and that is, well, all you need to run is a pair of shoes. But for a person of color, running can be a bit more complicated than that. And our guest is going to talk with us about it. Natalie Petruzzella is a historian and a marathon runner. She's also writing a book on American fitness culture. It's called Fit Nation: How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. She wrote about how running has always excluded black people. She wrote about that for the New York Times. So we want to hear from you. How do you think the running community could do a better job of supporting black runners and other non-white runners? Maybe you've experienced discrimination or fear while running because of your race or maybe gender identity. Join in. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Petruzzella, welcome. Thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. And it's actually Natalia Petruzzella, but it's easy to mispronounce.
I'm sorry. Natalia.
No problem.
Well, let's start off by taking a look at the sports history, running history. When and where did running really begin to become popular?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. And I think one of the most important things to realize here is that there's a distinction between running as a sport or running for survival and recreational running or jogging in this country. And I think that, you know, the point that the topic that we're discussing today, which is really about how hard it is to get out in your neighborhood and go running, is not about being a professional athlete. It's about being a jogger or a recreational runner. And that in the United States is relatively recent. It didn't really become a popular phenomenon until the 1970s.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting history there, and it goes back to the, I think, kind of around the 60s, wasn't it, when things kind of first turned toward exercise in that fashion?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that today in a lot of places, whether you live in a suburb or a city, it's very common to see people out running for exercise. So common that you barely bat an eyelash or notice them. That was really not the case in the United States until pretty late. I mean, even in the early 1980s, there are articles about those odd joggers who you see out in the street. That it really began to shift, though, in the late 1960s is the beginning of that shift. And that came from shifts in exercise culture, and specifically the expansion of the idea of exercise to not just be about lifting weights or calisthenics, but to be about what we would call today cardio. There's a really important book that was published in the late 60s by a doctor named Kenneth Cooper, who talks about the benefits of what he calls aerobics, but which we would call cardio today, which is running, swimming, cycling, that kind of exercise. And that science really gave a huge boost to the recreational running boom.
Yeah. And the state of Oregon is where jogging, I guess, was born. But Oregon was also the only state admitted to the union that actually barred black people from living there.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in that question there. So yes, Oregon's admission to the United States is the only state that had an expressly white-only clause. But that came long before recreational running culture in the 60s and 70s, right? But I do think it's not unrelated because, you know, there, of course, were people who were out running for fun in the 1950s or before. But in that late 60s moment, when exercise is becoming more popular, when cardio or aerobics is becoming seen as healthy for everyone to do, the really most famous popularizers of jogging are this is a track coach from Oregon, a guy named Bill Bowerman. And he writes this book called Jogging, which if you go back to today, you're like, I can't believe people had to explain this. It says, you know, go outside, start with a walk, speed up a little bit until you're breathing hard. And, you know, you should wear rubber-soled shoes. Like, it's very, very basic. But all of that had to be explained because it was such a new idea for people to go outside and do this, or even to think that getting out of breath was healthy. I mean, this is a moment when people associated getting out of breath with having heart attacks. And so it was a big shift to explain to people that, this is actually good for you. And Bowerman and the kind of Oregon cross-country and track culture was really an important site for popularizing that, particularly with that book.
And he went on to found a little company, too.
Indeed, he did. He went out. He went on to found Nike, which is such a, you know, obviously also so important in the commercialization of running and fitness culture. And one of the things, you know, as a historian, I'm a real geek who loves my archival sources. And if you go back to all the images in that book, Jogging, published in 1967, they're wearing like Converse in the pictures. Like they're not even trying to cross sell because Nike would not fully be Nike until 1972. At the time it was called Blue Ribbon Sports and was a much smaller outfit.
Wow. Well, you're talking about the marketing and the you look at the photos in that book and it's all white people.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that that's important. And one of the things that, you know, stands out to me so much as someone who's a runner, but also, of course, studying this history, is the fact that jogging is marketed as like anyone can do it. All you need is shoes and motivation. Just go outside. You know, this is equal opportunity. No health club membership necessary. And while all of that is to a degree true, it is so clear from the get-go that there's a real limit to that kind of universalism. And it's one that is limited, I think, most notably by race and by gender. That if you're a woman, as I am, you know, going out in the street and just running puts you in a very different kind of danger than if you're a man. And if you're a person of color, you know, there's a whole other level of scrutiny that you get. And so that's just, you know, your body, but then also neighborhoods. The late 1960s is already a moment when you're really seeing residential segregation in the United States, when you're seeing a distinction in where there are free community parks and running trails, et cetera. So not only do people get received very differently depending what they look like, but there are also very differing degrees of safety that you can enjoy if you live in a neighborhood where you're not worried about crime, where you have a park that is, you know, set up for those kind of recreational activities. And that gets real. That's very different along lines of race and of gender.
And even though in sort of what you would maybe mainstream media all pretty much showed white runners, that was not the case in publications, for example, that were aimed at black citizens.
Yeah, I think that that's right. So, you know, you have this kind of, you know, recreational running culture grows in popularity throughout the 1970s. And most of the kind of mainstream marketing that you see absolutely is of white people, men and women. Part of the promise was, you know, this is for everybody, men, women, children, you can do it as a family, but you almost always only see white people in mainstream publications. But of course, you know, this thing is marketed as very attractive and also kind of part of a leisure pursuit for people who, you know, have the time to work on their bodies, who might have white collar jobs where they sit at their desk all day and therefore they have to do physical work on their own. And so particularly for upwardly mobile African-American people, they're really interested in getting involved too. And so, you know, reading the African-American press in the 1970s and 1980s, it's very clear that they too were looking to start jogging clubs, you know, to buy products that showed that they were runners, whether they're sneakers or track suits. And so I want to emphasize that this culture, while it had certainly a whiteness in the way that it has always been presented, this is something that African Americans have long wanted to participate in as well.
Natalia Petrozella, our guest today, as we talk with her about running's diversity and inclusion issues. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today and visit with her. I think, 25-year-old Ahmad Ahmaud Arbery was jogging through a neighborhood in Georgia in February when he was shot and killed. Can you talk about how the running community has reacted to this event?
Yeah, one of the things that was really amazing and I think good to see when Ahmaud Arbery was tragically killed was that, you know, you always have people who are talking about, racist violence visited upon African Americans, as they should, kind of social justice advocates. But in this case, you really saw the running community start to chime in on that conversation, of which they are not always a part. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that there was this real disconnect that I was seeing on social media between runners who were white and who were like, oh my God, I've never had to think about going outside. Running is my escape. I just put on my shoes and head out the door. And then runners of color who were sharing stories, you know, very familiar ones, about how guarded they have to be when they're going out running. And I mean, some specific examples are never going out running after dark, wearing a sweatshirt of an Ivy League college to kind of showcase your respectability, having maybe like expensive earbuds or something to show, like to confer a kind of class status. And that was very surprising to a lot of white runners. And so I think that really sparked a kind of conversation that hasn't been had so much in the running community. And there's been a very vociferous response to that. A lot of people kind of opening their eyes to obstacles that they had not understood before.
Natalia Petrozella, our guest today. She's going to be with us right up till 12:30 as we talk with her about this whole topic of diversity and inclusion when it comes to running. And I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, the history of running, or jogging as it was originally known as, features a lot of people that look like each other, mostly white. We're talking about diversity in the running world and why many black runners don't feel comfortable running after dark or running in certain neighborhoods. Natalia Petrozella is a historian, a marathon runner. She's also writing a book on American fitness culture. It's called Fit Nation, How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. She wrote about how running has always excluded black people for the New York Times as well. And I hope you'll join in and share your thoughts and what ways is running accessible or inaccessible for you. Join in, give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Natalia, let's talk about that opinion piece for the New York Times called
Sure.
Jogging has always excluded black people. Talk about maybe first about what motivated you to write this. I think I've got the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Yeah, well, to recap a little bit of what we were talking about before the break, after Ahmaud Arbery's tragic murder at the end of February, I kind of watched the running community get into this conversation that was usually had among kind of social justice advocates about the perils of existing in the world while black, and often existing in the world doing very mundane things that many white people do without a second thought. Shopping, traveling, driving, walking, and in this case, going out for a recreational jog. And so what I saw was all of these runners like starting to both share experiences of how guarded they had to be if they were runners of color when they go outside, but then also white people kind of having their eyes opened to, wow, I never really thought of this thing that I always thought was just all about whether you are motivated enough to go for a run or not. I never thought that your race could affect your ability to actually do that. And so that is kind of, you know, my work in fitness history really prompted me to write this piece, looking at the way that jogging culture in the United States has come to be racialized as white. And I should say, I took pause in writing this because this was about the murder of a black man, and I am a white woman. And the reason that I decided to take up any space in this conversation was because in my work as a historian of fitness, I thought I had something to add. But I really want to make clear that I really think the leading voices on all of this should be the people of color who are bringing awareness to the struggles that they face when they just want to go out for a jog.
Yeah, well, for sure. And as you think back over the past 20 or 30 years, there have been some terrible incidents that have been a real, turned out to be a real problem. I know, I want to go back to the 1994 when a black man, a jogger, foiled a rape attempt. And the person who was kind of saved pointed out he was a black Superman, and but then the police and the press really kind of minimized him.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So I think we can't really understand that event in 1994, which took place in Central Park in New York City, without understanding the case of the Central Park jogger, which had taken place a few years earlier in Central Park as well. And one of the things that happened as jogging had become this like national phenomenon was that as more and more white people were out running, black people not only are not included in kind of the marketing of it, but they're also increasingly seen as a threat or even merely an annoyance to white runners. And so you see lots of articles that are sometimes, you know, making the point kind of obliquely like, oh, the jogger in the gentrifying neighborhood has to jump over the annoyance of, you know, the black homeless who are in the streets. Or much more extremely, when you have this case of the Central Park jogger and where a white woman who worked as an investment banker is raped and left for dead, several men of color are wrongfully accused of attacking her, and it becomes this enormous scandal where very much black men are presented as threats to legitimate white joggers. So I give you that background because it's a few years later in 1994, exactly the incident that you talk about happened, where there's a black jogger who you don't read about much in the mainstream press, who's out running, and he actually foils a rape attempt on a white woman. And the black press, and I'm quoting the Amsterdam News here, says, oh, you know, whenever it's a black man who's assaulting a white jogger, they're very quick to say the race of the person. But here you have a black jogger who actually was heroic, and they don't mention his race. They don't mention that he was a jogger, and they kind of minimize him as a do-gooder rather than a hero. And so I thought that was a really interesting and important example of the continued way that jogging gets coded as a white activity, and black people are seen as outsided and not allowed to occupy that space. And I think it's an important prehistory to understand why someone like Ahmaud Arbery in 2020 is seen as a threat when he's just out running.
Yeah, and not running at night. I was watching Allison, I'm forgetting her last name, who started the runners safety movement. Are you familiar with that?
Are you talking about Allison DeZier or maybe, or you're talking?
Yeah, Allison DeZier. That's who it was.
Yeah.
Started the runner safety movement, and I saw her describing, you know, here she's thinking about running, going running at 7 o'clock, and then thinking to herself, well, gee, am I going to get home before it's dark? And have all these kinds of things that most white people don't think too much about.
Yeah, I think, and I think, you know, as we said earlier in our conversation, I think that you've got to think about race and gender and how they operate here. And, you know, there was just this week a white woman running who was left for, who was found dead. And that's something that happens all too much. And that's still very much a conversation, I think, that we need to keep having about the perils that women face when they go out running, because that's, you know, it's still very, very real. But that is a more evolved conversation than the perils that people of color face when they go out, particularly, I would say, black men when they're out running. And the Arbery case has really prompted that awareness, which I think is really, really important. And if you want to, you know, really go deep and think, well, why have we been willing to have this conversation about women and not about black men? It's because we really have this much deeper cultural predisposition to see women, particularly white women, as victims and to see black men as perpetrators. And so, and ironically, that stereotype is why black men get targeted when they go out running. He must be up to no good, right? But it's actually made them victims in really important ways that the Arbery case that really highlights, and I hope is forcing a conversation that is not going to go away.
Yeah. Well, let's take some calls. You can join in with your own thoughts, questions, comments, or maybe experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi. You know, I always remember the African-American women that were fabulous track stars. I remember Jackie Joyner. She was beautiful, and she'd have her nails done, and she'd be, you know, ready to break out of the starting blocks and go. There's so many African-American women that are great track stars. And I wondered what happened to that and why that power, that influence, does that go back to the programs in our high schools, you know, where track and field are not as important? But I still to this day remember Jackie Joyner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point. And, you know, the first kind of point of pushback that I got on that article in the Times was, what do you mean? The Olympics are filled with African and African-American runners. How can you say this is a racially exclusive culture? And I do think that's an important point to bring up, if to say that there's a really big difference between elevating particular single unique athletes on a kind of world stage to cheer on from your television versus, you know, being okay with people of color running through your neighborhood. And I think that that is a real distinction that hasn't really been spoken about that much, and that really highlights why the story and the very important and glorious story of African and African-American excellence in professional sports in the Olympics, why that doesn't explain, and it's not the full story when we think of the much more mundane just going out for a run in your neighborhood. There's one figure who, you know, I regret not mentioning in that article, and I think bridges those worlds of elite sports and sort of recreational run culture, and that's Ted Corbett, who, I don't know if that name means much to you, but he was a New York City runner in the 1950s, one of the founders of New York Road Runners, you know, a real champion of the marathons, which became very pretty democratic events. And he was someone who was an elite athlete and an ultra marathoner, but was also very inspiring to get people running out in the streets and to encourage young people of color to do so as well. And he was around, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, so that same period. But I do think it's telling he never got really that national attention like in, you know, Red Book or Life magazine in the way that Bowerman and some of the other white proponents of the sport did, even though his career was tremendous in promoting recreational running.
Yeah. And I think for our coming Olympics, I think for the first time ever, we're going to have some black women marathoners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I think that entry into distance running is really significant. And we should celebrate this. Some people thought this was a very pessimistic piece, but I actually think it's an opportunity for an opening to make, you know, sports and recreational activities around running more inclusive.
Diana, thank you again. Let's turn to Regina in Mequonigo. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Your speaker made a comment about women, white women seen as victims of whatever's going on, and women in general being victimized by men in different situations as part of the, you know, men seeing women as being their possession or within their jurisdiction and not something that they can say something about or do something about, rather than I'm not expressing myself very well here, but the possessiveness of men over women in general creates some of these problems. And anything outside of them, the men think that they can do something about it, including what they think is men or anybody outside of their jurisdiction.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Comment, Natalia?
Yeah, Regina, I think that's a really good point. I lost you a little bit at the end there, but I think that this point about women's victimization while running being reflective of sort of a larger gender hierarchy is spot on. And I think running in particular, unlike some other women's fitness activities that might take place in a studio or in a gym, running is women out in public by themselves developing their strength. That's something which threatens a lot of like deeply held ideas that femininity should be fragile, it should be at home, it shouldn't be out, you know, it shouldn't be out in the world. And I think that that does contribute to a kind of, you know, that some violence against women runners by men, yeah, you can absolutely read that as a kind of reassertion of male power over women who are challenging that. One really unfortunate example of that was a few years ago, there was a runner who was killed. This happens all too much. And, you know, there were a few commentators who said, what was she doing out running anyway? She should have a treadmill at home. And to me, as a historian, that speaks so deeply to longstanding commentary by men that women's proper place is in the home. Let's not forget that prostitutes used to be called public women because they were women who were out in the street, and that made them not respectable and sort of open to all sorts of marginalization and violence. And I don't think I'm overanalyzing too much to say that the violence against women runners has a lot to do with that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Do you think companies that sell the gear, the shoes, the clothes, contribute to the running culture and sort of inclusivity of it all?
For sure. Well, one of the things that's interesting, you know, we started our conversation talking about Bill Bowerman's book in the late 60s, which was so not materialistic. Like, it's amazing. The guy who went on to found Nike, to co-found Nike, was not trying to sell you anything. Like, the whole point is that it was free. But by, you know, by the mid-70s and 1980s, you have various companies doing a very brisk business in running shoes, in sports bras, in running clothing. And I think that one of the main contributions of that is, of course, one, to meet a need, because you do need some specialized gear to do this comfortably. But it's also to make running a very sort of like upper class or upwardly mobile pastime. I can't count the number of articles in the 1980s that list off, in articles that have nothing to do with running, running and jogging as the quintessential yuppie activity. And a lot of that had to do with the gear, that when you buy this pair of sneakers or you put on this jogging suit or you have the fanciest, you know, technology in today's marketplace, that shows, one, that you can afford it, but two, and I think this is important, it's also a way to display that, you know, your work, the work that you probably do during the day, is cerebral work, and so you have to focus on your body in this separate, like, you know, activity that you participate in. And so, yeah, I think that in running and in other, you know, and in other fitness pursuits too, absolutely the marketing of the gear is part of perpetuating our culture. And I think in running, it's even more interesting to sort of think about it because the language of running is so much about egalitarianism and equal opportunity and all you need is the open road. But go to a road race and, you know, every year there's more stuff, compression sleeves and trackers and, you know, all of this gear that also shows, hey, I can afford to do this in a you know, not so minimalistic way.
Yeah. And as you were saying, for a black person, for example, you You talked about people saying that they need to wear some of that gear or some of that in order to make people realize that they're not out there to do them harm or whatever.
That is what, I mean, this is something I'm learning because it's not a body that I occupy. But yeah, speaking to Black runners and reading their reflections on social media, seeing that one of the ways to confer or to communicate, I'm not threatening, I'm a legitimate runner, is to have some of that expensive gear, you know, the fancy leggings or the really nice earbuds, and that's a way to kind of, telegraph that you are part of a community, not a danger to it.
Yeah. And at the same time, I was remembering, wasn't a black pastor who was carrying a radio or something, and he had the police pull a gun on him because they thought he had a weapon or something in his hands, and he was out jogging?
Yes, absolutely. That happened in Pittsburgh. It was a really well-respected Black pastor, and he went out. His name was Reverend Sheldon Stoudmire. Some of your listeners might know his work. He was known for being a jogger, and in his obituaries, some folks said, you know, he was fearless. He would run through the white parts of town, which I think is interesting in itself that that's something they remembered about him as a sort of brave move. But once he was out running, and he had a tape recorder in his hand, and it was mistaken for a firearm, and he was stopped by cops at gunpoint. And, you know, he took that as an opportunity to say, essentially, if even I, like a well-respected pillar of the community, can't even run through the streets with a tape recorder, I risk my life. Like, that is a real, real problem. So, this is something that is embedded in our culture and is still with us. But I am grateful this conversation is happening.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how do you think we need to change this, and maybe who should be making the changes?
Yeah, well, I think that there's some great work being done by kind of running organizations that are doing outreach to kind of, you know, foster interest in running in largely minority communities. And I think that's really important and really just also fun and nice and a way to get kids moving and people out doing a good, healthy activity. I do think that there's a limit to those activities because those are very much focused on, you know, people's individual willingness to go out and run. I think what would be really important is to make social and political changes that have very little to do with running per se, like safer streets. Right? Like having parks, like having running trails in neighborhoods that aren't just the wealthiest, whitest ones, like having physical education programs in schools where, you know, you're not only taught that to run, but there are community-based organizations and activities around it. I mean, I think all of those things, not only inspiring individual people to say, hey, I'm going to go try running, though that is important and I don't want to diminish that, but also doing the kind of public policy work to make sure that there are safe streets and safe spaces and community institutions that enable this to happen, that is probably even more important because it's very hard to, you know, I think it's truly wrong, actually, to blame somebody for not going out running when their streets are not safe to do so, right? When they, you know, their parents have to travel very far to work and can't take them out to a running trail, et cetera. So there are much more structural issues around community safety, I think, and infrastructure that could enable running culture to be much more inclusive.
And maybe some of those conversations will be getting going. I mean, we've had a lot of conversations here in the last few months over those kinds of issues, and let's hope those conversations continue. Natalia, thank you so much. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Natalia Petrozella, historian and marathon runner, also writing a book on American fitness culture called Fit Nation, How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. Great to have her with us. Appreciate it. Tomorrow at this time, it's Friday already coming. And that means Garden Talk. So we'll be joined by Kevin Esperito of Epic Gardening. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.